Tonight on Arena, Lisa Mulcahy on directing Prime Video's The Assassin, Cormac McCarthy brings Big Band to the RTE Concert Orchestra, and new poetry from Molly Toomey. #51551 is our text number. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and it's Ricochet in with you tonight. We'll start with Lisa Mulcahy. She's an award-winning writer and director renowned for her work in film and television. She directed Ridley Road, The Tourist, and the critically acclaimed Irish crime drama Red Rock. And in 2024, she won a Best Direction IFTA for her film Lies We Tell, starring Agnes O'Casey. Her latest series, The Assassin, has just been released on Prime Video. It's an action-packed thriller set in Greece and stars Keely Hawes as Julie, a retired hit woman living on a Greek island, and her estranged son Edward, played by Freddie Highmore. Lisa, you're very welcome to Arena tonight.
Thanks very much, Rick. I'm very happy to be here.
The Assassin was created by Harry and Jack Williams. You'd worked with them before. When did they approach you about getting involved in this?
I did a second season, two episodes of the second season of The Tourist, which was shot in Ireland the year before last. And shortly after I'd finished that, early last year, they contacted me about this series and asked if I would like to pitch for it, if I'd be interested in it. So I read the first episode, which was very exciting. Lots and lots of action and lots of challenges and fun. And so, yeah, I pitched for it, and whatever I said or whatever I showed them, they liked. So that's how it came about.
I'm always interested in that idea of a director like yourself coming in onto a series like this and pitching for it. How does that work? What do you bring to the conversation that you initially have with them?
I suppose you bring the connection that you have to the story and a clear understanding of the tone of what they're trying to do. Jack and Harry have kind of a similar tone quite often, not always in their shows, that often it's very dark. They can be quite violent, but there's always lots of humour and lots of humanity. So their writing is really great. So you just have to show, I suppose, that you have a real enthusiasm and, you know, this is something you want to bring to life. And there was this show is set in many different countries. So it was lots of challenges. It just was, you know, really, really exciting prospect. They put together visual images or musical images, sounds, and you pitch all of that. And, you know, either they like it or they ask you to come back for more, you know, or they don't. But in this case, they did, yeah.
And they obviously did. What did you think of the script? It was co-written by the brothers and Salima Lim. When you read it first, what was your first reaction to it?
It's great, really. It was really exciting. It's got a very exciting opening kind of 4.5 minutes, something that I hadn't done before. It's got lots of stunts, quite a lot of stunts. So that was exciting. It's always great to do stuff, new stuff, and also just work with, the character, the Julie character. It wasn't, you know, you don't see a character like her that often. And the relationship between herself and her son, you know, played by Freddie Highmore, it's just so much fun. But basically everybody can relate to it because it's really about a dysfunctional familial relationship. And I think we probably all have some experience of that.
Even if not necessarily with an assassin for a mother. We're going to take a clip from this. This is where Julie has a rare visit from Edward, who's played by Freddie Highmore, her son, but who's interrupted when she gets an unwelcome call from an old contact, Damien, who's played by Richard Dormer.
Same room as last time?
Up the stairs. Same room.
All right, I'll just...
Hey, did you ever try that Wagyu beef?
What?
You mentioned it last time you were here. You said you'd read about it.
That was 4 years ago. I went vegan.
Oh.
Go ahead.
Hello?
Hey, sweet cheeks. It's been a while.
Damien, how the hell did you get this number?
Doesn't matter. Listen, I got a job for you.
Well, after 10 fucking years, you don't just... Whatever it is, I'm not interested, all right?
Well, you haven't heard it yet.
I'm retired.
Julie.
My son's here. This isn't a good time, okay?
The target's right on your doorstep, and they're a dangerous target. And if I had any...
Look, with the greatest respect, why don't you shove it all the way up your arsehole, Damien?
Who was on the phone?
My boyfriend.
Did you just tell him to shove it all the way up his arsehole?
Yeah, it's complicated.
Whatever you do in your own time's up to you. I didn't know you had a boyfriend.
So you definitely don't eat meat?
Vegans don't tend to.
Just make smart-ass quips.
If the lack of mammal flesh turns us into total bitches.
Mum, just going to pop to the shop.
Fine, you really don't need to.
It's fine. Be right back.
Yeah, if that's my first experience of it, I'm sold. I'm sold on the entire series off the back of that. Tell me about Keeley Hawes and about Freddie Highmore. People might know him from The Good Doctor, from Bates Motel, from series like that. What would they like to work with?
Yeah, they're great. Both Keeley and Freddie have both been acting since they were children. And so, you know, they really have done it for a very long time. I mean, everybody knows Keeley from something. You know, she's been in some great series. And they had a great connection. They hadn't worked with each other before, but they they phoned each other, and then we met in London, the three of us, and we spent kind of a couple of days together, but they just got on really well. So they were extremely happy during this show, and it makes a huge difference when your lead actors are just enjoying the material and enjoying the process so much. And so it was just a fantastic experience for me. They're, you know, Keeley is quite, they're both really funny, and but they really, really know their stuff. So yeah, it's, as long as you know your stuff, you're fine.
Does that make your job as a director 100 times easier?
It does, yeah. I mean, you know, that you have as a director and actors, you have to develop a trust in each other. And if actors, particularly when they're so well known, if they feel that they can't trust you, you know, that you're going to show them in a bad light, it makes for a very thorny experience, or it can do. But in this instance, we just all were on the exact same page, and they just knew, they just instantly knew these characters. And Keeley had worked with the two brothers before, so she, you know, she just understood the tone of the shows and the characters that they love, you know.
You said before that you'd worked with the two brothers, Harry and Jack Williams, on series two of The Tourist. Did you take anything from that and bring it into this, or are they two completely different beasts?
Well, you know, you can, when they primarily wrote episode one, and you really can hear their voices. When Jack and Harry, when they're writing, you can really hear their voices. And when other writers come in, it's not that they're not good writers, but they just have different voices. And it was, this was tonally really quite similar to The Tourist. It's, you know, kind of crazy things happen, and ordinary people do kind of mad things, but it's always kind of got some sort of reality and humanity to it. And so this was similar as well, that you had just nuts things going on, but then, you know, reality just steps in again, you know. So it's credible, it's believable, hopefully.
I wanted to ask you about Daniel Netheim. He directed the other three episodes. So there's kind of three of yours and three of his. What's the handover like that? Is there a handover? Is there like a collaborative process to ensure a kind of a vision that runs all the way through the series?
Yes, if you were directing, because often TV series have several directors, and so in this instance, whoever's doing the first block, in this instance it would be me, you would be the main instigator with the other HODs, the heads of department, the creative people, in creating a look. And whoever's coming in next would essentially keep to that look, but they can have their own style as well, as long as it doesn't steer away tonally too much. So Daniel would have been seeing all the rushes from my day's shooting before he started. And he's also done, this was his third show that he has done with the two brothers. So again, he was very familiar with the tone that they like, the style of shooting that they like, stuff that they don't like. You know, you get to learn these things pretty quickly, because although the creators, Harry and Jack, aren't around, they're watching everything from afar. Mm.
There are a lot of special effects in this series. There's a fair amount of action as well. Did you enjoy directing those scenes? Are they chaotic? Are they something that gives you nightmares?
Oh, no, they're not chaotic. No, they can't be chaotic. Of all things, stunts can't be chaotic, because there's too much danger involved. So it's all about prep. I absolutely loved doing the stunts because it's just so exciting and it's fun and it's a privilege. Oh, my God, I'm going to work and I'm doing this sort of stuff every day. So, you know, doing shootouts or car chases or the various other fairly gory things that happen in this series occasionally, it's just a really fun thing to do. So yeah, I love being part of all that.
It means tonally you've got kind of quite huge shifts, though, as well, as you tend to, I suppose, in a series like this where you've got action, then you have quite serious drama. There are a lot of light moments as well. How do you as a director kind of negotiate all of those shifts, or is that something that you know you can just leave in the hands of your main actors?
No, I mean, it is a collaborative process. It's important for the actors that somebody else is watching them and engage in what they're doing. And so that's why you would sometimes you'd do a take and then you'd have a discussion afterwards and you'd try something different. So it is very collaborative. I mean, you know, they're very experienced and these actors are brilliant, you know, but there is people watching the whole way along, because tonally, in something like this, it has to feel a certain reality. It's not sci-fi, it's real. They're meant to be real people. And so whatever happens to them, even if it's crazy, it still has to be rooted in reality. So you're keeping, as a director, an absolutely keen eye on everything that the actors are doing at all times, and whether that feels that it's fitting in with what you've done so far.
Okay, we'll take a second clip from The Assassin. We're on a yacht this time. Julie encounters Sean, played by Jack Davenport. It's unclear whether he's a friend or whether he's a foe, but either way, they're in a tight spot and they're both armed.
Lynx deodorant. Man of your age.
I smell divine and you know it.
How'd you find me?
By not being shit at my job. The fat summer for you, there's a lot of people going to want a contract like that.
I'm flattered.
You want to tell me why you're worth so much?
Our line of work, you make a lot of enemies, don't you?
Is that why you retired? I thought you had a couple of good years left in you.
This has been fun. You're not really going to kill me, are you?
Oh, come on. I'm here as a friend, Jules.
Well, why don't you lower that gun?
Why don't we both lower our guns?
You first.
I wouldn't shoot you, Jules. Professional courtesy, if nothing else. You might think you're in deep shit now, but it is deeper and shittier than you thought.
That is the unmistakable voice of Jack Davenport as part of the cast of The Assassin. You made it in Greece. Is that something that we should be jealous of? People always have that misconception of that it's great fun shooting something in sunny climes like that.
So I was in Greece for 4.5 months last year. And in the Greek, you know, people are fantastic there, and the Greek crew that we had, they were great, but it was extremely hot. Like our first day of shooting was 39 degrees, and, you know, we were constantly on that day, it was possible that we might have to stop, because once you get to 40 degrees, you've got to stop shooting. And, you know, we're shooting exterior at a prison yard. We've got about 120 extras, our first day of shooting, so all the crew are trying to get to know each other. So it was, you know, challenging, but it was great. Very warm, very warm. You really have to keep be careful about keeping hydrated, and just, you do get a bit used to it, but it does take, you know, a while, a few weeks to get used to that. And we weren't always shooting outside, so that helped. Hmm.
There are some great scenes in this series. Do you have a favourite? Is there one that you can look back on and think, I'm very happy with that?
There's an opening sequence in episode one, which was really fun. We shot it over 2 nights, and it was our last 2 nights of my block. So by that stage, we were kind of a well-oiled machine. And there's something very special about doing night shoots. It's almost like the whole world sleeps while you're doing your thing. There's just something always very nice about it. And it was an action sequence. And so it was just a really, really fun thing to do. And if you watch it, you'll see it's like a one-shot, 4.5-minute opening sequence. And then some of the scenes between Keely and Freddie, just the drama scenes and the relationship scenes were just lovely, just to be, you know, not doing action, just two people talking to each other, because the writing is so good.
Can I ask you what you're up to now? Or is that a question you don't want to field?
No, not at all. I'm from a TV point of view, I'm looking for my next on the hunt for something new. So that's what, and I have a film in development. So as of yet, I just don't know exactly what I'm going to be doing next.
That sounds honest and fair. Lisa Mulcahy, it's been lovely to talk to you tonight on Arena. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
The Assassin is now on Prime Video. Welcome back to Arena. Cormac McCarthy is a piano player, an arranger, a composer, lectures at the MTU Cork School of Music and is the director of the Cork School of Music Jazz Big Band. He's played with the Common Ground Ensemble and with Notify, but this Friday he joins forces with the RTE Concert Orchestra to delve into one of his and my favourite kinds of music, big band classics. He will take us all the way from Fletcher Henderson to Count Basie to the modern big band classics, along with vocalist Dana Masters. And Cormac McCarthy, very, very welcome to the studio. You're here to talk about the big band music and about this particular show this weekend, but your background in music and your breadth of interests, they're wide and incredibly varied. Did you start out with piano? I read somewhere that you started out by listening to Bill Evans and Ahmad Jamal, and then you started playing from a relatively young age.
Yeah, well, I probably reached Bill Evans and Ahmad Jamal at about 15, 16.
Still a young age to
reach them. I guess. I started playing classical piano at 4.
Okay.
But I was exposed to lots of different types of music from a very young age because my father is a professional musician and he would have played traditional Irish music and classical music professionally as well. So I was kind of dragged along to lots of different concerts and taken away to on tour and got to kind of experience it that way.
You were playing professionally from 15, do I have that right?
Oh, no.
Semi-professional.
I was doing a handful of little gigs. I wouldn't call it professional. I was far from professional.
A handful of little gigs at 15 is still fairly semi-professional. Okay, tell me about the gatherings in Italy when you were a child, about Steve Cooney and about your dad, Johnny, and who else was part of that melting pot at the time? What was it like to be there and watching them play?
Yeah, well, I guess I took it for granted. It wasn't until I was speaking recently with Philip Watson from the Irish Times, and when I kind of just fleetingly mentioned this, he kind of said, oh, hang on a second, tell me more about this. This is not usual. We went to Italy pretty regularly. My father played with the fantastic pianist Antonio Breschi, who brought together lots of flamenco and Irish traditional musicians, some North African musicians, and kind of fused a world music sound before that idiom had really involved Irish traditional music. And it was very interesting. And there were certainly elements of jazz as well. And we spent quite a bit of time there when I was younger. So it was great just to be surrounded by all these different musicians from different musical backgrounds and just to see it all come together and how they spoke the language of music, I guess.
It seemed normal, though, at the time for you, whereas obviously it wasn't really.
Yeah, and it's probably taken me like 30 years to realise that it wasn't normal.
Traditional music is still hugely important to you as well. I know you're going to be working with Martin Hayes again soon, and you've been collaborating with violinist Ethan Ivrian on an album. What's that like moving between genres? Is it something you don't notice? Is it something that you have to make a conscious effort to alter from one to the other? How does that work for you as a performer?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I suppose it's somewhere between the two. On a certain level, you don't notice because you're just still trying to play music. You're trying to communicate. You're looking to try and find some level of meaning and depth in what you're doing and to, as I said, communicate with the other musicians with whom you're playing. But I guess there's also an element of trying to have some form of integrity and to be true to the style, no matter what music you're playing. And even if you are pushing boundaries, that there is an awareness of where the music is coming from as well. So it's a balancing act. And sometimes we get it wrong, but I think sometimes we might get it to a point where it's exciting.
In terms of jazz, where does that come from for you? You went to live in Chicago. Is that your kind of origin point for that?
No. Well, my origin point would have actually been the Cork School of Music Jazz Big Band when I was 15. Even up until that point, my father would have been interested in jazz and would have played records, jazz records at home. So I'd heard it from a young age. And I wasn't great for practicing my classical pieces when I was, a 10-year-old. I would just make up my own little ditties and, I might hear something on a jazz record and try and figure it out and kind of explore that way. And then at 15, 16, John O'Connor, who was head of the Cork School of Music Jazz Big Band at the time, he heard me playing somewhere or other, some party, and he said, why don't you come along? And I was thrown in at the deep end and I didn't know what I was doing, but I learned.
Isn't that the nature of all jazz?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. And I mean, but I just learned on the, you know, during rehearsals and gigs. And I had a lot of older mentors, you know, who at the time were probably about 18, 19, many of whom are actually now in the concert orchestra. So we'll be playing this Friday night. But that was where it started. And then big band music has been a big part of my life ever since, really.
What happens when you go to Chicago?
Well, I went there specifically to do a master's in jazz composition. And it was specializing in big band music effectively because there was a fantastic, I went to DePaul University. It was one of the best college big bands in the world. And I got to work with some, you know, amazing, amazing, iconic artists like Fiddle Woods, Jeff Hamilton. But I got to write for them. And I suppose that was part of the reason why I chose to go there. I wanted to really fully immerse myself in the music. And I had a fantastic teacher, Thomas Mata. And it just, ever since, it's stayed a part of my life. So it's something I hold dearly and I really love.
Probably a silly question, but a good jazz scene while you were there as well?
Oh, yeah. yeah, absolutely mind-blowing. And I learned so much, so, so much.
I want to ask you, just before we take some music, because we do have some music both that you're going to be playing and some of the connected pieces as well. But tell me about Rhapsody in Blue, because you know, it's an extraordinary piece of music, but rehearsing for it nearly ended you, apparently?
Yeah, well, I guess that was kind of a point at which, up until then, I had still been largely pursuing classical piano career, let's say, because in college I'd been studying classical piano, and I was asked to do Rhapsody in Blue at short notice. I had something like 6 weeks to learn it, and I remember I learned it in three, and just as I was I had it down, I could feel my hand starting to fail on me, and then didn't play for another 2.5 weeks, and played tentatively for 2 days before the concert, and somehow managed to get through it. But to be honest, my hand ever since has always given me trouble, and it's
Gershwin's fault.
It's all Gershwin's fault, yeah.
I think for people who maybe haven't, I've been warned not to be too nerdy about this item tonight, but for people who maybe haven't come across the Glenn Miller Band's version of Rhapsody in Blue, which is one I only came across a couple of years ago, it's just an extraordinary take on that. I'm going to play something here, and I'm so pleased that we've chosen this. It's a clip from one of the giants. It is the kid from Red Bank, from Count Basie's The Atomic Mr. Basie from 1958. Does nothing but bring joy to my heart. That's the great Count Basie and the kid from Red Bank. So bring me into the big band era of this concert, Cormac. What can we expect from big band evolution?
Well, we're going right back to the start, first of all. Playing some music by Fletcher Henderson, which is from 1927. Same year as Rhapsody in Blue, actually. The Henderson Stomp. So we're going to basically focus initially on the origins of the music and how it all came together, and then from there progress through to Duke Ellington, fantastic sound, swinging sound of the 30s and 40s, the Cotton Club, through to Basie and Billy May, who would have arranged a lot of vocals for the Basie Band and Ella Fitzgerald, and then in the second half we're going to look at some more contemporary repertoire, stemming from the music of Bob Brookmeyer, through to Maria Schneider, Darcy James Argue, and I've written some music myself as well for the night. So yeah, it should be a lot of fun.
That's great. I'm going to ask you about that in a minute, but let's just take a little something else. It's an example of what you'll hear on Friday if you're going to the concert. It's from a previous one that you did with the RT Concert Orchestra. This is Gershwin's Fascinating Rhythm, sung by Dana Masters and with yourself, Cormac McCarthy, on piano.
Fascinating rhythm, you got me on the go. Fascinating rhythm, what a mess you're making. The neighbors want to know why I'm always shaking. Each morning I get up with the sun to find that night no work has been done. Once it didn't matter, but now you're doing wrong when you start to clatter. Won't you take a day off, decide to run along somewhere far away? Oh, how I long to be the gal I used to be. Fascinating rhythm, you got me on the go. Fascinating rhythm, you got me on the glow. Fascinating rhythm.
As that was just playing, you were telling me something about that recording. How was that done?
Yeah, that was, it brought shivers actually to my spine. That was done during COVID at an empty NCH where we were all spaced, you know, a couple of metres away from each other with screens between us. So it was a challenging recording session.
I can imagine so, because by the very nature of big band music, I mean, its origins are in dance halls and juke joints and with crowds of people who dance to the music.
Yeah, and the musicians would usually be crammed onto a reasonably small stage as well. So there's a lot to be gained from being right next to everyone, physically close to one another, so that you can really lock in rhythmically. And the energy that brings is something very special and something that's necessary in the music. So trying to generate that when we were all, you know, meters apart was difficult.
Yeah. I'm fairly sure it's not something that people maybe necessarily appreciate about big band music, but I read Cab Calloway's autobiography recently of Minnie the Moocher and Me, and it's great because it deals with all of his early big band years and his time in the Cotton Club and then them travelling on the road as well. And essentially he talks about how if a song didn't make a crowd move, then it was pretty much cut from the repertoire. It wasn't there.
Yeah, well, I mean, this, you know, it was the popular music of its time. And I mean, even my grandmother, who's, you know, she's 94 now, but she still talks about big bands visiting when she was growing up and going to dances. And it was the pop music of their time. You mentioned Glenn Miller earlier. I mean, she was buying Glenn Miller records, you know, and she was listening to that music when she was growing up in the 40s, you know. So it's it was pop music of the time and people danced.
I'm still buying Glenn Miller records, but I may be in the minority. What is it, I mean, aside from all of that, what is it about the big band sound in particular that you admire so much? Is it the work that goes into the orchestration, the freedom of the soloists, what the band stood for? What is that?
I think it's a mix of everything you just really succinctly mentioned. The arranging / orchestration element of it is something that's quite detailed and something that, you know, I really enjoyed delving into and something that everybody really respects and admires. Even, you know, the word arranger in different musical genres doesn't necessarily carry a whole pile of gravitas when it probably should. But in big band music, it's, you know, the word arranger is kind of held up there as, you know, this is a serious composer. Often, you know, somebody would have written the music from scratch but would still be referred to as an arranger even though they've composed all the material. So just that element of the orchestration is something very, very special. And then I suppose the dynamic range, and that's something that, you know, you'll experience at the concert on Friday, is, you know, the ability of the band to be incredibly loud at times but also then very, very subtle and bring out lots of different colours and And then, of course, the rhythm as well. So, I mean, you combine all those different elements and it really is a very, very special idiom.
I have a little clip of something I want to play here just to maybe illustrate vocal range. This is Basie and his orchestra again, but with the wonderful, extraordinary Ella Fitzgerald on vocals, doing a song called Shiny Stockings.
Shiny stockings, shiny stockings. Chick with great big stockings too. When you changed your mind about me, why, I never knew. I guess I'll have to find a new kind, a guy who digs my shiny stockings too.
Be honest with you, I could just do that for the rest of the evening here on the program. That is Shiny Stockings is the name of the song. Count Basie and Ella Fitzgerald. Maybe talk to me a little bit about the cult of personality around the band leader, because it is important, whether it's Basie or Duke Ellington or whether it's Cab Calloway or whether it's, you know, they're the ones who hold everything together and they're the kind of name on the marquee.
Yeah, I think it goes back to it being pop music again of the time and needing to put a face and a name on the front of an album cover. Because, you know, when big band music started to become a thing, when, you know, in the, let's say, the mid-20s, that's when record sales across the world took off. So there was a huge market there to be tapped into. And this people then could go to the dances and dance to this music. So by having a band leader associated with the songs that were being released, you know, I'm sure it was just good marketing. But also, you know, you take someone like Duke Ellington. I mean, he was larger than life in every sense, both musically, personality wise. You know, he was a bad guy, but, you know, in the best possible way. And his music, you know, to this day, for me at least, still sounds really, really cutting edge and modern. And you know, because he just embodied so much of the scene at the time. And a lot of these guys, you take Basie in the 50s, let's say, as well, he kind of encapsulated a lot of the vibe that was happening around that time. And of course, like the likes of Glenn Miller would have been taken, you know, to visit troops, etc. And it was, these guys were household names at the time. And they were, yeah, cult heroes.
I'd hate for people to think that big band music is something that's, you know, trapped in aspic or something that's, you know, just left up on the shelf and that we bring down and have a listen to every now and then. In the concert, you're going to be looking at more contemporary big band music as well. What are we talking about?
Yeah, well, like contemporary big band music is something that really interests me because it takes a lot of influences from other musical idioms as well. You know, I mean, there's Fred Sturm did a whole Radiohead project with the blessing of Radiohead, you know, which is absolutely fantastic. And like I've done arrangements for, you know, including elements of traditional Irish music with big band, and that's a lot of fun. But we're kind of at the concert on Friday, we're focusing a lot on the kind of Bob Brookmeyer lineage. So Bob Brookmeyer came through the kind of cool jazz school with Jerry Mulligan in the 1950s. But then became like this incredible big band arranger, band leader, writer, and also teacher, an amazing teacher. And he would have taught the likes of Maria Schneider, who's like multi Grammy award winning big band composer, and Darcy James Argue. And we're going to feature some of Bob Brookmeyer's music, Maria's music, and Darcy's music on Friday.
Okay, I want to play a little bit of Bob Brookmeyer's music just so people can get an idea of what we're talking about. This is Bob Brookmeyer and the New Art Orchestra. It's from 2001. It's called Seesaw. ¶¶ That's Bob Brookmeyer and the New Art Orchestra. You were saying earlier you composed something yourself. Is it especially for the night?
Yes. Well, the big centerpiece of the night actually is an arrangement of the slow air Portnabucchi for Mick Marshall on trombone and the big band. So it was almost like Mick sent me a task, you know. He mentioned Portnabucchi and said, I'd really like to do this, you know. I've been messing around with it on trombone for a long time. Would any chance you'd be up for it? And it was difficult to square the circle, I'll be perfectly honest, and to try and find ways that could be respectful to the tune, but also utilize the different colors and approaches that the big band can bring. Mm. But it's been very enjoyable, and I think people will like it. You know, I think it's going to be something different.
And what else are you working on at the moment?
Well, I'm actually, well, for this concert, I've also done some arrangements, some more contemporary arrangements of some Ellington tunes. So I Got It Bad and Perdido. So they'll be heard as well on Friday. And then I've just been writing a lot of music recently, and I have a new record coming out with fantastic violinist Ethan Ivrean. That's coming out in November, and that's my next show actually, is after this week. Next week I'm with Aoife at the Kilkenny Arts Festival, and so I've just been writing a lot of music at the moment, and it's something I love to do, so I feel very, very privileged and to work with great people like the RT Concert Orchestra.
It has been brilliant to have you in. I absolutely 100% can tell you that if I were not sitting here presenting this radio programme on Friday night, I would be in the National Concert Hall. Big Band Evolution with the RTE Concert Orchestra is at the National Concert Hall on Friday, 1st of August, this coming Friday. You can get the tickets, as usual, from nch.ie. And Cormac McCarthy also appears with Martin Hayes and the Cork Opera House Concert Orchestra at the Cork Opera House on Wednesday, September the 10th. Cormac, thanks for coming. Cheers.
Thank you, Rick.
Now, in a change of pace, poet Molly Toomey grew up in Lismore, County Waterford, and now lives in Cork. She made her debut with the award-winning Raised Among Vultures 3 years ago, a book that explored some of the markers of young adulthood, from relationships with partners and parents to mental health. Chic to Be Sad is her second collection. It continues the themes of the first book and widens the range, and I'm delighted that Molly Toomey is in studio with me now. Molly, I don't know where to start with this. I think I'm going to start with a poem in the new collection with the title Dear Checkout Girl Who Refused to Sell Me Wine. Maybe introduce that to us, tell us where that comes from, and then maybe you'll read it for us just to begin.
Fab. So yes, this poem is literally about being in Tesco and being at my wit's end and being really tired and fed up with life. And then the girl wouldn't sell me my bottle of wine because she thought that I was too young, but I'm nearly 30. So it was just like the last straw, you know, and you're just like, oh, I'm going to get this and then everything will be fine. And then it's not fine and you have to go home and you're just like, oh, fed up with life. So this poem came from that.
And all you can do is attempt to turn that into something creative.
Yeah, I'll read it. So
please.
Fab. Dear checkout girl who refused to sell me wine. I'm the best locked toilet stall for a good weep. You're younger than me and already were targets for Botox and chemical peels. Let's bunk off by the cages of crushed cardboard. I've never held a party, but I've thrown a fit right here by glamour and good housekeeping. We'll grab hooded blankets, crunchy bars and sour worms. For years, my mind was a locked trolley wheel. Now I'm too jaded to care what people with fresh mint and corn-fed lamb think of my choco hoops and discount red. If we were dogs, we'd be urn-bound on a bookshelf or long decomposed under heather and moss. I just flunked my driving test, found a tax bill choking my front door. I'd say I was scorching the candle at both ends, but tea lights are back at full price. You don't look it, you repeat when I tell you my age. Neither of us asked for this.
That again, you've got to turn that into something creative, surely, at the end of a day like that. Chic to be Sad is the new collection. It's a great title. It's catchy. Is it a little provocative? What's the thinking behind how you name this collection?
Yeah, so I suppose it's tongue in cheek. You know, I've dealt with this a fair bit of sadness myself, and maybe, you know, growing up, I would have probably glamorized sadness and glamorized the idea of, you know, being kind of mysterious and melancholic and looking out windows and feeling the weight of the world and not really engaging with communities or your family and friends and like being that little bit distant. I suppose the title is making fun of that a small bit. Yeah.
It's framed around a fire in your childhood home. What was it about the fire that you wanted to return to? How central is it to Chic to be Sad?
Yeah, so there was a fire in my childhood home in Lismore in 2022, which was just after I kind of published my first collection. So it was the first thing that kind of got me writing again, and you know, to return to the childhood home, our childhood home, with my brothers, my parents. Thank God nobody was injured. We were very lucky. It was quite scary. It was, you know, a small bit devastating, but it also really, the resounding feeling after the fire was one of gratefulness that, you know, we had each other, and the realization that things really don't matter at all. To know everything is, you know, even sentimental things, they don't matter. I think what matters is one another. What matters is my family. And I was, you know, so grateful that nothing disastrous happened. You know, all we lost were things. So that's the fire kind of starts the collection. There's a poem at the end about the fire as well. But really, those poems are about my family. You know, the fire is a way into writing about my family and my past as well. Yes, I'm nearly always writing about people that I love through different domains.
Musicians frequently talk about the difficult second album. How did writing this compare with writing the first collection? When, you know, I think it's that discussion people have all the time about how you have your entire life to write the first album or collection or novel, and then the second one is difficult, harder. How was it for you?
Yeah, absolutely. It was difficult. I think with the first collection, like, it's everything that I had ever written. And I had a great sense of naivety, maybe, with the first collection, almost that I didn't expect people to read it, or didn't think about that part. I didn't think about reviews, or didn't think that people would talk to me about it. Whereas this time, I think with the writing process, there was a voice in the back of my head that was kind of like, oh, people are going to read this. Oh, God, be careful. Or, you know, you know, you really make this good because people are going to read this, you know, quote unquote good, whatever that means. So that was a bit difficult. But I also am very lucky to have a great writing community in Cork and to be surrounded by incredible poets who help you through some of those kind of struggling days or whatever. So, which is great. But yeah, it was, you know, it was great too. Like, I'm so grateful and so delighted to have a second book. Yeah, I feel really lucky, and I feel really supported, you know.
A lot of the poems in here are from, you could call it the front line of young adulthood. What sort of life challenges are in these poems?
Yeah, so I kind of return to themes of an eating disorders. My first collection, Raised Among Vultures, was predominantly dealing with my recovery from an eating disorder. And I'm still, I mean, it is years since I was diagnosed, but I would still consider myself as someone in recovery. And I still have days that are harder than others. So it still comes up in my writing. You know, the body is essential theme for me. So definitely still dealing with different things like my relationship with exercise, my relationship with food. It still is a reoccurring theme for me.
Yeah, they sort of come together in On Banging a Kettlebell Off My Jaw, which is in the collection, which opens with the line, I used to love hunger. Would you read that for us, perhaps?
Yeah, of course. So, On Banging a Kettlebell Off My Jaw. I used to love hunger, punching its time clock in my stomach for the graveyard shift. I was proud to ignore a clicking bone, a septic wound, to keelhaul myself under stainless steel and so many fingerprints. Now, in pulse fitness, I swing the kettlebell's cold fist against my jaw. Blood drips on a decade of dried sweat. My vision refuses to unblur. Nobody checks on me, not the girl sprinting in inclined bursts, nor the man pounding a punch bag the shape of a tear. I wish I had swung harder, passed out and bled enough for a caution wet floor sign, for an ambulance to arrive with a woman in high viz who might hook me up to fluids. Grant me the rest I cannot grant myself.
That's On Banging a Kettlebell Off My Jaw from Molly Toomey's collection, Cheek to Be Sad. Molly, you've said that you're looking at the men in your life in this collection. Who are you looking at? Who are you observing?
Yeah, so, you know, I certainly am certain there's poems about my dad, there's poems about my partner Mike, there's poems about my two brothers, Paul and Michael, there's poems about my granddad. Yeah, but I also look at the women in my life too, but it's always in a kind of, I think I am a poet, hopefully a poet of observation and not judgment or anything like that, and always just trying to find playful new ways to observe. I find really I write about those that I love, and those that I love are the greatest source of inspiration to me because they are the people that I'm thinking about the most, which is maybe tough for those that I love. Who often?
How do they feel about turning up in your collections? It's a good question, actually.
Yeah, it's a good question. Sometimes it can be hard if it's complicated material, and I am lucky that nobody has ever stopped me publishing something. But I know that it can be hard. But I think as well that they somewhat enjoy it. I think my dad had a great time with the poem in my first collection that went on this podcast. And so many people heard it. And I think he kind of enjoyed it. You know, it must be weird to appear in poetry. I wonder what it feels like for them. But generally, they're really, really supportive.
Have you ever said to anybody in advance, you might want to avoid that particular page or those particular pages in a new collection?
Yes, of course. Well, like, yeah, I mean, there's one or two poems now in this book where I was like, oh, I don't know if I should publish this or whatever, you know. But there's poets like Tom McCarthy and Fionn O'Rourke who are very much like steady and are, you know, of the idea that, you know, the poetry is what comes first. And I subscribe to that. And also, I also think it's your intention. Like, what is your intention behind the work? If your intention is to hurt someone, then maybe I would rethink that. But my intention is never to cause harm. And I hope that I never do.
It does not seem that way. I'm going to ask you to maybe read one more just to finish us out. You have a wonderful, wonderful way with titles. Tell us about My Brother's Friends Draw Dicks, which I never thought I was going to be allowed to say on Radio 1.
So this poem is literally what it says on the tin. After the fire, my brother was showing his friends around the house, was showing them the destruction the fire that had caused. And he was walking around. They were walking behind him. And when he had his back turned, his friends were drawing dicks in the smoke on the windows, on the walls, on different objects around the house, which we didn't see until later. And at such stage, my dad was afraid people had broken in, but that was not the case.
It turned out instead it was something far more sinister than that. Yeah. Maybe you read that for us.
Of course, thank you. My brother's friends draw dicks. After the fire, my brother shoulders the side door, where earlier he punched its swollen lock. He jokes with his friends that his Xbox survived, as it's made from the same adamantium as Wolverine's claws. Soot and foam swallow his workout mat, his weightlifting gloves. He enters the room where he used to sit cross-legged with a train set, a wrestling ring, figurines of Edge and Randy Orton. He tugs at the burnt layers of wallpaper to reveal a Peter Pan mural. His memories are a skewer of marshmallows held over a flame, a pack of Bensons he was caught with and forced to smoke at once. When he turns his back, his friends draw penises like thumbs up on the rippled mirror, by the handle of the bathroom door, between the skylight's ruptured veins. This is how they cope with discomfort. Dicks fat as votive candles, glimmering in every warped frame.
And that is an extraordinary way to finish your readings from your current collection. Who do you admire as poets, either contemporary or not?
I love Leanna Sullivan, Victoria Kennefic. You know, there's Alvy Carrer. So many. Kelly Michaels is amazing. I notice I've just said all women, but I do love male poets as well, like Tom McCarthy. Diane Seuss, so many.
Molly Toomey, it has been absolutely joyful to talk to you tonight. The poetry collection is called Chic to Be Sad, published by Gallery Press. And thanks a million for coming into the studio.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is pretty much it from us for tonight here on Arena. The show is produced by Sheila O'Callaghan. Research is by Leah Murphy and Paul Shields. Our broadcast coordinator is Ollie Hamilton. And sound supervision is by Niall McMonagall. I'm Rick O'Shea. And I'll talk to you again tomorrow night from 7. John Creedon is next.